I've been involved in leadership for over 40 years. You know, I didn't always command 800,000 people. I started commanding a squad of 11, then a platoon of 40, then a company of 150, a battalion of 600 and so. Next thing I knew, I was commanding a brigade of 2,500, a division of 16,000. One day I turned around, I was in charge of 800,000 people. But I found it that there's certain very fundamental things that apply to any size organization. And that's what I want to talk to you about today. Now, more importantly, it applies to any type of organization. And that's very, very important to me because, you see, every single person in this room is a leader. Every one of you is a leader. Of course, you are leaders in your business. That's why you're here. But many, many of you have children in school, and therefore you've chosen to become a leader in the school system in one way or another. Others of you are leaders in Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and community activities of one sort or another. Many of you are leaders in your church, and every single one of you is a leader in your home. So what I'm going to talk about today applies not only to any size organization, but it applies to any type of organization. And while I'm talking about today, I want you to kind of think of your all of your leadership roles that you play and think how these principles apply to your leadership in whatever capacity it happens to be. Now, I know what's going on out there. Somebody's saying, wait a minute, Schwarzkopf. You know, I'm not a born leader. Joe over there is a born leader, or Susie's a born leader, but I am not a born leader. Let's settle that one right now. I don't think there is any such thing as a born leader. I don't believe that the circumstances of your birth have one darn thing to do with your ability to lead. If you go back and look through history, the leaders that have been proclaimed as great leaders were really rather ordinary human beings who had just prepared themselves during their lifetime and suddenly found themselves in extraordinary circumstances. And when they were able to step up to the challenge and meet the challenge, they go down in history as being great leaders. But the circumstances of their birth had nothing to do with their ability to lead. Let me give you an illustration. Schwarzkopf family are great dog lovers. We have two dogs, both of them imported from Germany. Now, this is a pretty big deal, okay? Imported from Germany. One of them's name is Orso. Orso is a German shepherd. Magnificent black and shiny coat, big bushy tail, pointed ears, long fangs hanging out of his mouth. The last time I was able to capture him and pick him up and weigh him, he weighed 90 pounds, and that was quite some time ago. A magnificent animal by anybody's description. Orso, by the way, is the Italian word for bear. The other dog is also imported from Germany. His name is Grizz. That's short for grizzly bear. Grizz is a wire-haired dachshund. Okay, looks like a cross between a dust mop and a hot dog, all right? And on a very rainy day, after he's very wet, he weighs all of 18 pounds. Now, let me ask you, which of those two animals do you think is the undisputed leader in the Schwarzkopf household? Grizz, of course. You see, Grizz has never looked in a mirror. Okay? The only thing Grizz has ever seen is Orso. Grizz thinks he's a 90-pound German shepherd, all right? And worse yet, Orso thinks he's a 15-pound wire-haired dachshund that causes me a lot of problems. But you see, the circumstances of Grizz's birth didn't make any difference to him. Doesn't make any difference whether you're tall, short, fat, skinny, black, white, purple, green, or blue, whether you're brilliant or whether you have to work very hard academically for whatever it is you achieve. None of that matters. As long as you are able to think like the human equivalent of the 90-pound German shepherd, you too will be a great leader. So let's talk about leadership. What is leadership? We live in a world that's crying out for leadership today. You hear it all the time. We would not have had the debacle in Somalia if we'd had better United Nations leadership. We wouldn't have our troops sitting on their rears in Bosnia today if we just had better world leadership. We live in a country that's crying out for leadership. You know, I guarantee you that in the next election, no matter who the candidate is, they are going to claim that they have it, this thing called leadership, and they are going to insist that their opponent does not have it, this thing called leadership. What is it that personifies, you know, a Georgie Patton with his pearl-handled pistols, but at the same time describes a magnificent work of Albert Schweitzer in Africa? What is it that can describe the devotion of a Mother Teresa, the charisma of a Diana, or the iron will of a Margaret Thatcher? I will confess to you that even though I have been involved in leadership for over 40 years, I have never, ever come up with what I consider a satisfactory definition of this thing called leadership. I'm sort of like the Supreme Court justice was about pornography. Remember when they said, what's pornography? He said, I don't know what it is, but I recognize it when I see it. And that's sort of where I come from in this definition of leadership. But I thought since I was preparing a lecture on leadership, I really ought to come up with a good definition. So I went to Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary. Here it is. This is really heavy stuff, so brace yourself for this, okay? Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary. Leadership, the quality of a leader. That really isn't very helpful. I said, all right, I'll just go look up leader. Here it is, Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary. Leader, something that leads. You get the feeling that the people who write dictionaries have a little bit of trouble with this leadership thing? Fortunately enough, there were some examples in there. Leader, short length of material attached to a fishing lure. That I can identify with, okay? I've been attached to so many fishing lures in my life, that's my single greatest qualification for calling myself a leader. Leader, primary shoot of a plant. Leader, member chosen by his or her party to manage party activities. Let's see, here's another one. Leader, the first or principal performer in a musical group. We're back to Madonna again, can't escape her no matter what. I like this one. Leader, the principal member of the party elite in a totalitarian state endowed of official ideology with heroic or mystical character and who governs with a minimum of constitutional restraints and extreme national demagogy. Saddam Hussein we're dealing with here, okay? You put this all together and you come to the conclusion that a leader can be a turnip green or a politician. And given the state of affairs in Washington, that may be a somewhat redundant statement. I'm not sure. From those of you who did not clap or applaud, that is not a political statement. That's just a joke is all that is, okay? But a leader can be a rock star, a leader can be a dictator. And I will confess to you that my 40-some-odd years of being involved in leadership, I've met leaders who were each of those, and I've met leaders who were all those combined, and I still can't give you a good definition of this thing called leadership. Now, I know what it's not. Leadership is not managership. That was a popular concept back in the 50s and 60s. You heard this all the time. A manager is a leader. I reject that outright. I reject it. Managers manage things like shops and systems and stores and computers and banks and all these sort of things, okay? I've met a lot of people who are great managers, but they were lousy leaders. They were great at financial management, they were great at systems management, but they forgot the fundamental element of their organization. People. Leaders lead people. I was so glad to hear that in your film today. You know, that your most important commodity is your people. Leaders lead people, people with hopes and dreams and ambitions, just like the leaders have hopes and dreams and ambitions. But without these people, all the high technology systems and equipment and organizations that managers manage would utterly fail. Leaders lead people. I used to take brand new second lieutenants that come into my outfit and I'd say, look, go down to the motor pool and find the best tank in the motor pool. Stand at rigid attention in front of the tank and say, right face. Nothing happens. Nothing happens at all. I say, go down to the airfield. Find the most fancy jet down there. Find the best helicopter down there. Go over and whisper into the side of the helicopter. Fly. Doesn't fly. Nothing happens until you put people in that tank or that airplane. But you see, it's more than that. Because nothing happens unless you have people who are refueling and rearming and repairing and maintaining that tank and that airplane. But it's more than that. It's only when you have logisticians back in the rear who are sending forward fuel and ammunition, critical spare parts, that anything at all happens. And it's even more than that. You have to go all the way back to the factory where these ultra-high-tech systems are being manufactured, and on a daily basis in those factories, people are making the critical spare parts that it takes to keep systems like this operating. It's only when you have all of those people involved that this two highly sophisticated systems are going to be able to do anything at all. I used to say, Lieutenant, leaders lead people. You must remember that. And while I don't know an adequate definition of leadership, we do know some things about leadership. I think I know what the challenge of leadership is. You know, if I had a handful of $10,000 bills, we used to have them. I have a handful of $10,000 bills. I said, everybody who follows me through that door over there, I'll give you one of these $10,000 bills. Even in this very sophisticated audience, I dare say that some of you all over there are going to be trampled to death, okay? But does that make me a great leader? No. Not at all. Because you see, all I am doing is asking you to do something that you would do for anybody under any circumstances. That's not what the challenge of leadership is all about. I think the challenge of leadership goes something like this. The challenge of leadership is to get people, underline that word mentally, people, to willingly, underline that word, do that which they ordinarily would not do. That's the challenge of leadership. That's why leadership in the armed forces is so important, because we're doing what? We're asking men and women to do the one thing that all of us instinctively in the crib are born knowing we do not do. And that's risk our very existence. But we're asking people in the armed forces to do this willingly. So the challenge of leadership is to get people to willingly do that which they ordinarily would not do. Keep that in mind, because I'm going to come back to that. Now we know some other things. Whenever there are three or more people together, there is always a leader. Whenever there's three or more people together, there's always a leader. The interesting part about that is it's not always the person who thinks they're the leader who really is a leader. Okay? We have all been in organizations where somebody thought they were in charge. Somebody thought they were the leader. And then a crisis occurred, and everybody in the organization turned to someone else for the guidance that they needed in that crisis. Okay? So you're not the leader just because your title is boss. You're not the leader just because you sign a paycheck. You're not the leader just because you have the power. So what does it take to be a leader? Well, it takes competence, first of all. It absolutely must have competence. You know, you can't be a great leader unless you know your job. But I got to tell you, through the years, I have met many, many very competent people who were still terrible leaders. So I think I've come to the conclusion after all these years that the single most important ingredient of this thing called leadership is character. Character, because you see, leadership involves things like sense of duty, a sense of honor, ethics, integrity, indeed even morality. All these things are involved in leadership. Now, I've been challenged on that. Okay, I've been challenged by the skeptics who said, Schwarzkopf, this leadership thing, you know, this character business, it isn't important. Hey, we've had two elections where quite literally we had members of the press stand up and say, character is not an issue here. We don't talk about character. You know, that's kind of scary. And I go back to these skeptics and I say, you know, go back and look at the leadership failures in this country in the last 100 years. You will find that about 99%+ of all the leadership failures in this country in the last 100 years were not failures in competence, they were failures in character. Look at the Wall Street scandals that occurred a few years ago. These are the most competent financial managers in the entire world. That's something called greed getting away. Okay, and that happens to be a character failure. We had a president, Nixon, who was literally swept into office by an overwhelming vote because the American population thought he had great competence, and then he was kicked out of office because of his character, because he lied to the American people. Okay, this thing called character is so important. We have learned that over time, any time a true crisis arrives and people must pick the leader from their peers, they always pick their leader based upon the character of their leader. Based upon the character of the leader. You see, they have the competence to do it. What they need is leadership, and leadership is character. There was a recent survey that scares the hell out of me, I will confess. 75% of all the people surveyed say they lie to their bosses on a regular basis. That's kind of overwhelming. But you know what? When they went back and asked them, why do you lie to your bosses? They said, because our bosses are unethical. And therefore, since our bosses act in an unethical manner, it's perfectly all right for us to act in an unethical manner. The ethics of an organization, the moral climate of an organization is established at the top. It is just that simple. And therefore, what do you have to be a leader? Well, you don't have to be loved. You know, it'd be nice if you could be loved. We all want to be loved as a leader, but all too often when you're the leader, you're called upon to make the kind of decisions that'll cause you not to be loved. You know, leaders live in glass houses. People look to their leaders and hope that their leaders are better human beings than they are. And that's perfectly logical, because they want to feel that the people are making the critical decisions that are going to affect their life, and therefore are going to affect the life of their family, and also going to affect the lives of their coworkers, and therefore going to affect the entire community. People like to think that the person that's making those kind of decisions is someone who holds himself or herself to a higher set of standards and values than they indeed hold themselves to. Let's face it, there's not one person in this room that wants to be led by some jerk off the street. You want to be led by somebody that you think is really, really special. So you don't necessarily have to be loved to be a leader, but you definitely must be respected. Okay? I've met a lot of great leaders who were not loved, but I've never, ever met a great leader who wasn't respected. And leaders are respected because they accept responsibility. They accept responsibility for their actions, but more importantly, they accept responsibility for the actions of the entire organization that they lead. I've had people say to me, yes, well, I delegate my responsibility. I say, I'm sorry, you can't do that. If you are the leader, the responsibility is always yours. You can and you should delegate your authority. Delegate your authority to empower those people within your organization to do what it is you ask them to do, but you cannot delegate your responsibility. As a leader, it is always going to be yours. I like to use another analogy about the great football quarterbacks. Think about the great football quarterbacks. The really great ones, when the team wins, he gives credit to the team. When the teams lose, they take the blame themselves. That's sort of what this thing of leadership is all about. That's sort of what this thing of accepting responsibility is all about. And therefore, you know, it's not always fun. You know, people, you say to me, Schwarzkopf, when it stops being fun, you ought to get out. Man, I could think of a million times it wasn't any fun at all. Okay? Not at all. Leadership is a series of emotional peaks and valleys. And if you're really lucky, you got more peaks and valleys, but not all the time. I can remember times when my morale was as low as a snake's belly. You know, higher headquarters have been criticizing me for something I said or did. You know, and things weren't coming together in the organization. We weren't accomplishing what we wanted to accomplish. We had people getting hurt on the job. And my morale would be terrible. All of a sudden, out of nowhere comes Rear Rank Rudy. You all know who Rear Rank Rudy is. You know, Rear Rank Rudy is a soldier who has one boot tied one way and the other boot's tied a different way. One trouser leg's in the boot, the other trouser leg's out of the boot. The zipper is either half up or half down, depending upon how you want to look at it. Belt buckle's over here, necktie's over here. You know, looks like your typical Naval Academy graduate is what, you know. But all of a sudden, out of nowhere, comes Rear Rank Rudy. And Rear Rank Rudy says, sir, can I talk to you for a minute? The last thing you want to do at that time is talk to Rear Rank Rudy. But you're the leader, so you have to. You say, yeah, Rudy, what is it? And he said, well, a bunch of the guys and me, we were talking about you last night in the barracks. You think, oh, boy, here it comes. You know, I really don't need this right now. You say, yeah, yeah, what's this all about? He said, well, we were talking about you last night in the barracks. We know you care about us. We want you to know that we think you're doing a pretty good job. Wham! Boy, I'll tell you, the batteries are instantaneously recharged. You are ready to go out and take on the dragons and the windmills and anything else that you got to take on. Because, you see, that's where the true rewards of leadership come from. Okay? The true rewards of leadership come from the leadership itself. If you're in the leadership business only for the next tangible reward, okay, the next citation, the next medal, the next promotion, the next pay raise or something like that, if that's the only reason why you're in the leadership business, you are doomed to disappointment. You see, we all enter this pyramidal workforce. And down here at the bottom where we enter, there is plenty of room for all of us. But as we move through life, okay, and up on that pyramid, people are constantly getting knocked off the pyramid. And eventually, every single one of us is going to get knocked off the pyramid. Somebody out there say, yeah, well, I'm going to make it to the top of the pyramid. Yeah, you might make it to the top of the pyramid. I've seen a lot of people make it to the top of the pyramid. They just stay there for a while. They decide to jump to a bigger pyramid, and they often miss. Okay? So if the only reason why you're in the leadership business is for the next tangible award, you are doomed to disappointment. But if you understand that the true rewards of leadership come from leadership itself, if the day you are knocked off that pyramid, you can look back and say, gosh, that was a great team we had. We did really good stuff together. Together. I'm proud of what we did. If you can feel that way the day you get knocked off that pyramid, you will carry that to the end of your days, and it'll be a constant source of pride and joy in your life. Because the true rewards of leadership just plain and simply come from the leadership itself. Now, I'm sure there's somebody out there right now saying, oh boy, you know, Schwarzkopf said he's going to give me something I can use in my organization, and up until now, all he's done is give me a sermon. So I'm now going to give you some pretty practical things that I think will work in any organization at all. And I hope you can find some room in there for your organization. First rule, no organization will ever get better unless the leaders are willing to admit that something's wrong with their organization. No organization is ever going to get better unless the leaders are willing to admit that something is wrong. When I first came in the Army, we ran what we called annual training tests. And they would take us out and we'd run over hill and dale for about a week. Everybody was running around behind us with little clipboards writing stuff down. At the end of the week, they'd run us into a hot, stuffy classroom where we'd probably fall asleep because we didn't care what they wrote down on those clipboards. The only thing we cared about was the final grade. And so we'd wake up about the time the final grade was coming, and it was always the same, 98.5%. Now, even to this young, inexperienced second lieutenant, I knew that outfit wasn't that good. I knew I was that good. As a matter of fact, I was better than that. I knew that. But you know, I knew the outfit wasn't that good. But because we got that grade, we never changed anything. You don't change when you're 98.5% good. So every single year, we went back and we trained on exactly the same subjects we trained on before. Okay, and we allocated our fuel to exactly what we allocated to before, and we allocated our ammunition to exactly what we allocated to before, and we allocated our funds to exactly what we allocated before, and most of all, we made sure we did over and over again those things that we really do well, so that when our bosses came down and looked at us, we looked good, and boy, they thought we were terrific. You don't change when you're 98.5% good. During those days, in the 50s and 60s, some Department of Defense organizations adopted a motto, zero defects. Now, zero defects is a great motto if you're in the business of manufacturing critical equipment that's going to be used in an operating room in a life-saving circumstance. But zero defects is the stupidest motto you can ever adopt when you're in an organization like the Department of Defense. It's totally people-dependent. You are going to have defects, whether you like it or not. We went to a place called Vietnam. Guess what? We discovered we had a few defects. So when Vietnam was over, we recognized that our assets were going to dry up completely. Our allocation was going to be meager at best. And those of us that decided to stick around and say, you know, we've got to start doing something different here. We've got to start admitting what's broken out there. And we've got to take these very meager assets we're going to get and apply them to things that are broken rather than just doing the same thing over and over year after year after year. And I'm sure somebody out there say, well, of course you did. That is so logical. Listen, that is a basic philosophical change in the mindset of the United States Army. Up until that time, you're supposed to be can-do Army. Schwarzkopf, can your outfit do this? Can do, sir. Can your outfit do that? Can do, sir. Can your outfit leap over the Empire State Building single bound? Can do, sir. Is your outfit more powerful than locomotive? Can do, sir. I mean, you never said can't do. Matter of fact, if you said can't do, they'd say, get rid of that bum. We don't want him around here. Doesn't have a can-do attitude. But now you see, we are suddenly asking our leaders to say, can't do. I expect to go down to a battalion that's training out in the field. And I say to the battalion commander, what are you doing today? He says, sir, we're doing D. And I say, why are you doing D? And he said, because we went to the National Training Center 6 months ago, and I found out this outfit is very good at A, B, and C, but they are terrible at D, and therefore I am training them on D. And you look out, and sure enough, they look terrible out there, and you're glad. And you go right next door to exactly the same kind of battalion, and they're doing XYZ. You say to the commander, why in the world are you doing XYZ? The guy over there is doing D. He said, hey, we can do D fine. And we can do A through W fine. I just found out that we're not very good at XYZ, and we're out here doing XYZ, and sure enough, they look terrible, and you are happy about it. Okay? Now, it may not seem like much, but that single philosophy made the difference between the quality of the army that we sent to Vietnam and the magnificent army we sent over to Desert Storm. Just that little thing alone was the principal thing that made a difference. Organizations will never get better unless the leadership is willing to admit that something is wrong. Now, there's a corollary to that. You all remember that before the Gulf War, Saddam Hussein in Iraq fought an 8-year war against Iran. At the end of 6 years, they were broke. You know, Iraq is the second largest oil producer in the Gulf. If they applied the revenues from their oil sales to the standard of living of their people, they'd have one of the highest standard of living in the world. But instead, they had spent all of their money on acquiring arms and ammunition and the weapons that you're hearing about today and all that sort of business. And by the end of 6 years, they were flat broke. They had borrowed from all over the Gulf, which was one of the causes eventually of the Gulf War. And Saddam Hussein recognized the problem this was going to cause within his country. So he called in a group of his closest friends and advisors. And he explained the situation to them and said, look, I want a brainstorming session here. I want you to be open with me, and we got to come up with a solution. So does anybody have any ideas? One of his closest friends raised his hand and said, you know, Mr. President, you are so closely identified in the eyes of the Iranians with this war that it's hard to believe we will be able to negotiate a settlement so long as you're president. So why don't you step aside as president for 6 months? We will negotiate a settlement with the Iranians. At the end of 6 months, we'll make you president again. Saddam Hussein went over and grabbed his friend, took him through the door, and shot him dead. Came back into the room and said, okay, now does anybody else have a good idea here? Okay? We laugh. Tragically, that is a true story, by the way. But we laugh, but every single one of us has been in an organization where the leadership has said, okay, I really value what you have to say. I want you to speak up and tell me what's troubling you. And the first person that says something negative, bang, we shoot the messenger. Okay? Organizations will only get better if leaders are willing to admit what is wrong. And you must have a climate within your organization where people are allowed to say that something's wrong. Okay, that's point number one. What do we do then? Leaders set goals for their organization. Everybody said, oh, for crying out loud, Schwartz. You know, I went through all those management by objective classes we all had to go through, you know, 10 years ago. I understand all about goal setting and everything else. I understand all about goal setting, too. You know, 1965, I arrived in Vietnam in July. Landed at Thon Son Airport. It was hotter than 400 hells, and they immediately rushed us in to a small tin Quonset hut because the day before the VC had blown up the airport. The first thing they gave me was a 3x5 card, and it said, Schwarzkopf, on this 3x5 card are the 18 reasons why we're in Vietnam. Anytime you want to know why we're in Vietnam, you know, take this card out, read these 18 reasons, and here it is. I took the card out. I didn't understand half of what was on the card. But I was also told, oh, by the way, wherever you go, you must carry that card in your right rear pocket because senior officers can challenge you at any time on why you are in Vietnam, and you should be able to pull this card out and you can tell them why it is you're in Vietnam. And of course, it also applied to members of the press and foreigners or anybody else who asked you why you're in Vietnam. Think of how stupid that is. I mean, really, think of how stupid that is. You know, 2 weeks later, I was lying face down in a rice paddy. Machine gun bullets were screaming over my head. I wasn't sure I was going to be alive 5 minutes later. Am I supposed to take out this card and find out what the hell I'm doing here? I mean, really, that's exactly where that card belonged, right back here, okay? You know, goals are only meaningful, number one, if everyone in the organization understands the goals. But more importantly, if everyone in the organization clearly understands the role they are going to play in accomplishing the goal. That's what's important about establishing goals. Okay, understanding what it is you're going to do. I get asked all the time, how did you hold the coalition together over there? 800,000 people, cross nationality, cross ethnic, cross cultural, cross religious. How in the world did you hold them together? It's simple. We had one goal. And everybody over there, from the highest ranking general down to the lowest ranking private in a foxhole, everybody over there clearly understood what our one goal was. Kick Iraq out of Kuwait. And everybody clearly understood the role they were going to play in accomplishing that goal. And I got to tell you, over and over again, somebody come running into my office. Oh, my goodness, we've got this cultural difference with the Arabs. I mean, they think this way and we think that way. And we've got to convince them that we're right. That's pretty presumptuous. You know, their culture is 5,000 years old and ours was 216 years at the time. But they say, oh, well, you know, we've got to solve this culture. I'd say, why? Well, you know, because you know, we got this difference in culture. I'd say, wait a minute. How does that affect the goal? Well, it doesn't. I'd say, good. Then we don't have to do it. Okay, we don't have to do it. How do you eat an elephant? You eat an elephant one bite at a time. You don't eat the whole elephant all at once. Okay, that's what goals do. Goals are used by leaders to focus their organization. Very important to focus their organization. But you know what else they do? They tell the organization what they don't have to do. That's what goals do. They tell the organization what they don't have to do so you don't waste your assets, you don't waste your energies on doing things that don't have to be done now. You can do them later. Or maybe you choose not to do them at all. But you don't do things that don't accomplish your goals. Leaders set goals to focus their organization. Okay, now we've established our goal. What's next? Standards. You show me a high-performing organization, and I will show you an organization where the leaders demand high standards. You show me a low-performing organization, and I will show you an organization where the leadership accepts low standards. Why is that important? I came home from high school one day, and my dad said, son, how'd you do on your math test today? And I said, Dad, I did great. I got an 80. That was the highest grade in the class. And my father looked me straight in the eye and said, "Do you know that that means you don't know 20% of everything you're supposed to know about that subject?" I thought that was really stupid. My son came home this Christmas, and I said, "I know you were really worried about that finance exam you were taking in college. You know, how'd you do?" And he said, "Well, Dad, I got an 85. I'm really happy." And I said, "Did you know?" And he thinks I'm stupid too, okay? But standards are important because it tells people what are expected of them. Tells your people what's expected of them. And why is that important? Well, imagine a brand new sitcom on television, okay? Newlywed couple gets up in the morning, gets dressed, has breakfast. The breadwinner goes to the door where she turns to her spouse and says, some of you men just did a mental flip-flop, I realize that. No, the breadwinner goes to the door and turns to their spouse and says, "I'm going off to my first job and I'm really excited because I plan to fail." Tilt? What? No. No. People go to work to succeed. Nobody goes to work to fail. Everybody, from the CEO down to the clerk in the mailroom, everybody goes to work to succeed. That's why people work. But before they can succeed, they must know what the measure of success is. And the measure of success is this thing called standards. And what happens after you establish your standards? Think of the last time any of you all were in an academic classroom for the first time. Walked into your new class, what's the first thing you said?
"What does it take to pass this course? Do they grade on a curve here?"
You see, you wanted to know what the measure of success was, and then you were going to do what? You were going to do better than that. You were going to do better than that. That's what you set out to do. Now go back to the fundamental challenge of leadership, to get people to willingly do that which they ordinarily would not do. Okay? We all know there's vast untapped potential in the workforce out there. We all know that human beings normally do not work to their greatest potential all the time. It just is built into our nature. So how do you get them to work to a higher level of potential? It's simple. Standards. You set your standards high within your organization. Leaders do that. You can set your standards 100%. You're not going to get 100%. But by golly, you may get something in the high 90s. But if you set your standards at 70%, that is exactly what you are going to get. 70%. Leaders establish high standards for their organization. Okay? Take care of standards. What's next? Well, if I haven't learned anything about human beings other than this, this is one of the most important things I've ever learned. Failure is contagious, but success is infectious. Failure is contagious, but success is infectious. I have seen units out there, literally, who have failed so often at what they undertake that whenever they undertake any task, no matter how trivial, no matter how simple, they undertake it with the expectation of failing. And guess what? They fail every single time because failure is contagious. But I've seen a new leader come into that same organization, give them a task that they couldn't fail at. And then when they succeed, say, "Oh my goodness, look what you all have just done." You know, and go around and shake a few hands and pat a few people on the back and hug a few people, you know, and reinforce success. And then give them another task. And when they succeed at that, he stands up in front of them and says, "I am so proud to be your leader. I am so proud of what you have done. You are a bunch of winners. Everybody wants to be a winner." And maybe, you know, hand out a few certificates. Give somebody a medal. Promote somebody from PFC to corporal. No big deal. But within the organization, reward and reinforce success. And then you do that over and over and again. And before long, you know what? That same organization that undertook every task expecting to fail now undertakes every single task expecting to succeed. And guess what? They do, because success is infectious, just like failure is contagious. So leaders reinforce success within their organizations. Now, oh, by the way, leaders also accept some mistakes. Oh, wait a minute, Schwarzkopf, we were with you up until then, but I mean, surely you're not talking freedom to fail. I'm not talking freedom to fail. I believe what Vince Lombardi said, "Show me a good loser, I'll show you a loser." Okay? But, oh, by the way, I won't ask you to raise your hands because the lights are on in here, but I will ask you to take this little exam question mentally. How many people in here learned something about how to do your present job by screwing it up the first time? Yeah, sure. Absolutely, we all did.
Until we become El Supremo, and until we become the great leader, and then we say, that's it, no more mistakes in this outfit.
That's crazy. That is crazy. When you're dealing with human beings, you must allow not freedom to fail, but you must allow a latitude to learn within your organization. Leaders establish a latitude to learn within their organizations. At the same time, they're reinforcing success.
Okay, one last point. Every great leader I've ever known has something in common with every other great leader. Every lousy leader has something in common with every lousy leader. It kind of goes like this.
Good leaders don't tell people how to do their job. Good leaders don't tell people how to do their job.
Don't get me wrong. They tell people what to do. They allocate resources. They establish standards. They discuss concepts. They talk timelines and they talk expectations. They do all of that.
But they don't tell people how to do their job. I think for two reasons. Number one, if they got a half a brain, they understand they don't know how to do every job in the organization better than everybody else. That's why you got all these other people in your organization. But more importantly, I think they understand that old geometry theorem. You know, the whole is the sum of the parts. Okay? They understand what I choose to call the synergy of individual initiative. They understand that if you go ahead and challenge people to do what they know how to do best, and you give them the authority, and you give them the resources to go out and do what they know to do best. And if that's happening throughout your entire organization, when all of the pieces of your task come together, it's going to exceed anything you ever imagined possible in your life because you allow this synergy of individual initiative to take place. Great leaders do not tell people how to do their job. Now, what about lousy leaders? Well, lousy leaders are so lacking in confidence in themselves, they don't have any confidence in anyone within their organization. So they don't allow anybody in their organization to make any decisions at all. But because they have no confidence, they don't make them either. And the whole organization sits out there awaiting guidance, awaiting instructions, awaiting direction, and when it doesn't come, one of two things happens. Number one, the organization stagnates, or worse yet, the organization starts pulling itself apart in 20 different directions. Okay? Great leaders don't tell people how to do their job. Now, if you put all those points together, comes up to something like leaders admit what's wrong, leaders establish goals for their organization, leaders establish high standards, leaders reward success, leaders establish a latitude to learn, and leaders don't tell people how to do their job. They power down within their organization.
Now forget everything I told you. Now just forget it all. Because I am now going to give you the two roles to 21st century leadership. And all you got to do is remember these two rules, and you will be a great leader in the 21st century. I was a brand new major general. I'd just been promoted to major general. That was the good news. The bad news was I got signed back to the Pentagon. Walked in the Pentagon, and they made me the number two man in charge of personnel for the United States Army, Active Reserve, and National Guard, about 4.5 million people at the time. I'd been in my job 1 week, and I came walking to the Pentagon. My boss comes walking out of his office with a suitcase, and he says, Schwarzkopf, I'm heading for Germany. I'm going to visit the troops over in Europe, and then after I visit the troops in Europe, I'm going to swing over to the Far East, and I'll visit the troops in the Far East, and I'll be back in about a month. And he picked up his bag and walked out the door, headed down the hall of the Pentagon, and I absolutely panicked. I ran out the door behind him. I said, wait a minute. You know, I have been here 1 week, for crying out loud. What am I supposed to do if the chief of staff of the Army calls, or the secretary of the Army, or the secretary of defense, or some dumb politician from over there on the hill calls? What am I supposed to do? And he looked me straight in the eye and he said, Rule 13. I said, yes, sir, Rule 13. Do you mind telling me what Rule 13 is? And he said, sure, Rule 13. When placed in command, take charge. When placed in command, take charge. Remember I talked about leaders accepting responsibility? Leaders making things happen. This same boss one day was receiving a briefing on a very complicated subject, and I know he didn't understand one word of that briefing because I didn't understand one word of that briefing. I was a hell of a lot smarter than he was, but I never told him that because he was a hell of a lot higher ranking than I was. But anyhow.
But to my amazement, at the end of the briefing, he made a decision and sent this decision out to be implemented throughout the entire United States Army. So when everybody left the room, I said to him, I know you didn't know anything about that subject before they came in here, and I know you didn't understand that briefing. How could you possibly have made a decision? He said, Norm, you know what? I may have made the wrong decision just now. Doesn't make any difference. Doesn't make any difference. He says, that problem has been in the Pentagon for 6 years. For 6 years, nobody has understood that problem well enough to make any kind of decision at all. He said, you know, I may have just made the wrong decision. It doesn't make any difference. Because what I've done is I've moved this problem out to this great army of ours where there are thousands of individuals who, even if I have made the wrong decision, will turn it around and make it the right decision and will be well on our way to solving this problem. But if I had not made a decision today, which 1 year from now we'd be visiting the same problem right here in the Pentagon, it would have been in the Pentagon for 7 years and we'd be no further along in the solution of this problem than we are today. Rule 13, when placed in command, take charge. Do something. Just do something. Grab the responsibility and do something, and it really doesn't make any difference what it is you do. Take charge. I said, okay, man, I'm getting ready. I'm going to take charge. And he picked up his bag, and he started to walk down the hall, and I walked behind him. I said, but could you give me a little bit of guidance? What should I do about the recruiting program, and what should I do about the enlistment program? What should I do about the re-enlistment program? What should I do about the promotion program? And what should I do about the women in the Army study? And what should I do about the equal opportunity study? And what should I do about human relations? And what should... And he turned around to me and he said, Rule 14. I said, yes, sir. And he said, Schwarzkopf, do what's right. Do what's right. Notice he didn't say, do what you think the chief of staff of the Army wants you to do. He certainly didn't say, do what you think I'd want you to do. He very definitely did not say, do what makes you look good. No. He said, do what's right. And you see, now we've come full circle right back to this character business again. Because you know what? When the truly tough decisions have to be made, we normally know right here what the right thing to do is. The tough part is doing it. And especially when no one's there. When no one's there to grade your paper. When no one's there to say he really knew what the right thing to do was, but he went ahead and did the wrong thing anyhow. When you can get away with doing the wrong thing. That's when this thing called character becomes so important. Rule 14. Do what's right. That brings us full circle because it brings us back to the Gulf. At the end of the Gulf War, Barry McCaffrey, who's now the drug czar up in Washington, he was one of my division commanders. He said, you know, if we'd had their weapons, they'd had ours, we still would have won. We still would have won because we knew our cause was just. All of our troops knew we were doing the right thing. We knew we were doing the right thing because from all over the world, we were receiving tons of mail from people just like you who wrote us and said, we support you, you're doing what's right. Okay, I don't know if you know it, but right before we kicked off the offensive, we were receiving 4 tons of mail a day. That's 28 football fields piled 6 foot high with mail every single day. Tell us we were doing what was right. Since I have been back to the States, one thing I hear probably more than anything else is people come up and say, thank you, General Schwarzkopf, for restoring my faith in my country. I say, wait a minute. Wasn't General Schwarzkopf that restored your faith in your country? It was 541,000 magnificent American men and women who were ripped on short notice from the breast of their family. They were sent halfway around the world in the most inhospitable environment that you can imagine, where they had to put up with the heat and insects of the desert during the day and the cold and the damp of the desert at night, and they had to go to sleep dreaming dreams that nobody should ever have to dream, and they had to face death, and some of them indeed gave their lives. That's who restored our faith in our country. We should never forget that. Okay, we should never forget that. More importantly, we should never forget why they did it. Why did they do it? Why did they do it? They did it simply because their country asked them to, and therefore they thought it was the right thing to do. That's why they did it. But you know what I want to ask these people? I want to say, why in the world did you ever lose faith in your country? Why in the world did you ever lose faith in the United States of America? You know, I've had a great life. I've traveled and lived extensively okay, in 48 different countries in this world. And I hope you clearly understand, with all of our warts and all of our problems and this sort of thing, the United States of America is the greatest nation on the face of this earth, bar none. Bar none. You know, our friends tell us that regularly. Our enemies tell us that grudgingly, and our former enemies are doing what? They're all trying to be like us. I mean, look what's going on over there in the former Soviet Union. They're all trying to be like America. And yet, for some reason, in our own country, we have people constantly telling us how bad we are. Constantly telling us how bad we are. The day I left Saudi Arabia, my counterpart said something that I will never forget. He was admittedly anti-American. But he said, you know, if the world is only going to have one superpower, thank God it's the United States of America. Stop and think about that. Stop and think about the nations that could have emerged as the world's only superpower during our lifetime. Hitler's Germany, Tojo's Japan, Mao's China, Stalin's Russia. Any one of those countries could have very easily emerged as the world's only superpower. And think of the darkness that would have descended across this earth if that had happened. But they didn't, and we did. That places an awesome responsibility on our shoulders. Awesome responsibility on our shoulders. Because it places an awesome responsibility vis-a-vis our role in the world today. But I think far more importantly, it places an awesome responsibility on us as to what kind of a nation we are going to be unto ourselves. And once again, doomsday prophets and the naysayers are crawl out from under their flat rocks. The American people can't handle it. American people can't handle a leadership role. American people aren't tough enough. They point to gridlock in Washington, D.C. They point to riots in the streets of California. They point to crime in Chicago. They say, this is what America's all about. America isn't tough enough to assume a leadership role. I don't buy that for one moment. I don't believe that for one second. America is not gridlock in Washington, D.C. America is not crime in the streets of L.A. America's not riots in Chicago or any place else. That's not what America's all about. America is hundreds of thousands of villages and towns all over this country, loaded with people that still have all the same beliefs, all the same ethics, all the same value systems that have always made America great. That's what America is all about. If we're the world's only remaining superpower, so be it. All we got to do is remember two things. Rule 13 and Rule 14. By golly, if we're the world's only remaining superpower, we must be willing to take charge when required to do so. But more importantly than anything else, we must always, always do what's right. And none of us will ever again have any reason to lose faith in this great nation called the United States of America. Thank you very much for your attention.